and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. The unprecedented rise in incarceration in the U.S., the momentous breakdown of the black ghetto, concerted attacks on traditional welfare policies and their replacement with a regime known as workfare, the origins of prisons many centuries ago in Europe, and their relationship to policies aimed at disciplining and managing the poor. All of these historical, political, and social developments, and many more, are addressed and laid out in relation to each other in a recent book by Loïc Vacon called Punishing the Poor, the Neoliberal Government of Social Insecurity. Vacon has also written about such things as how to define a ghetto and its collapse, what functions modern-day prisons really serve, and whether the widely held, at least among the left, the widely held notion of a prison industrial complex actually holds water. And by the way, later this hour you'll hear Vacon argue that there's no evidence for it. Loïc Vacon is an ethnographer and professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. His books include Prisons of Poverty, Urban Outcasts, and most recently, Punishing the Poor. When Loïc Vacon joined me recently in our KPFA Berkeley studios, I asked him what's happened to the numbers of people incarcerated in the U.S. since the 1970s.
Well, what happened since the mid-70s is really a tremendous surprise and development, because everybody expected between 1945 and 75 for the prison essentially to recede, if not to disappear. And indeed, the U.S. was leading the world in progressive penality. In 1973, Nixon is presented with a report that recommends closing down facilities for juvenile delinquents and establishing a moratorium on prison building in the country. And at that time, a book is published in 1975 called A Nation Without Prisons that proposes that the U.S. will lead the rest of the world towards creating societies that have gotten rid of prisons. We must remember that this was not unrealistic. In the 1960s, the prison population of the U.S. was decreasing slowly by 1% a year and reached its lowest level in 1973 with 380,000 inmates. And then what happened in the four decades since? Well, exactly the opposite. Every decade after 1973, the U.S. doubled its prison population. We witnessed a stupendous increase in incarceration to where the U.S. eventually became world leader in incarceration, with today more than 2.4 million people behind bars. And so we have to ask the question, well, why this sudden U-turn? I mean, everybody expected the prison to disappear, and instead it becomes this gigantic sort of albatross on the societal scene.
So does a rise in crime explain the explosion in the numbers of incarcerated people?
Well, that's the conventional answer, is people say, well, yes, the prison increased because crime increased and therefore there are more prisoners. The problem with that answer is that in reality, crime measured by victimization studies and not by crime as recorded by the police, which actually measures the activity of the police and not the activity of the criminals. Victimization studies show that starting in 1975, the crime rates fluctuated up and down without a particular trend, and after 1993, dropped dramatically. So, in fact, the crime rate cannot explain the incarceration rate, and you can show this with a pretty simple statistic. You can compute the number of people you have behind bars per 10,000 crimes. So you're holding your volume of crime constant, and you say, how many prisoners do we have per unit crime? And then you see that in 1975, the U.S. held 26 convicts for every 10,000 crimes, whereas by 2005, it held 135 convicts per 10,000 crimes, which means that the U.S. became six times more punitive during those decades.
Does this just mean that punishment's becoming more efficient, that we're putting more people who've committed crimes behind bars?
No, it means that for the same amount of crime, well, crimes that did not used to be punished by incarceration are punished by incarceration, but also it means that many other social conditions, such as urban poverty, dereliction, which used to be treated through the social welfare arm of the state or through the medical arm of the state, have begun to be treated by rolling out the police, the courts, and the prison system. And the reason why this happened in the United States is that the United States, after the mid-1970s, went to two dramatic transformations. One is a transformation of the condition of labor and the condition of the labor market. Starting in 1973, you see a decrease in union protection, you see a stagnation, even a decrease in the minimum wage, you see a rise in unemployment and a very steady and spectacular rise in the number of part-time jobs, flexible jobs, jobs that do not provide benefits and protection and so on and so forth. So this meant that this established a large volume of social insecurity, social instability and poverty at the bottom of the class structure. The second major transformation was the collapse of the black ghetto. Out of the revolt of the 1960s, the ghetto, which used to contain all African Americans in their restricted zones inside the city, the ghetto collapses for a variety of reasons, and then it no longer serves to contain this stigmatized population. And what this means is that, of course, well, another institution must arise to contain and control a population that is black, poor, derelict, considered even dangerous, and the institution that arises to replace the ghetto after its collapses is the prison. In a sense, the prison is rolled out to contain the disorders created by the mounting poverty and inequality. And where does this mounting poverty and inequality concentrate? At the bottom of the system of places that forms the city, that is in the collapsing black ghetto. And this is the reason why the prisons in the United States after the mid-1970s, and this is a stunning development, prisons become blacker. That is, the prison population becomes more and more black, and then later also Hispanic, even though during this whole period, the cohort of violent criminals becomes whiter. That is, if you take the ethnic distribution of criminals, violent criminals in particular, who are supposed to be the prime recruits for imprisonment, well, you observe that your criminals are becoming whiter. And during that same period, your inmates, whose number are ballooning, going through the roof, your inmates are becoming blacker. And so the only way that you can explain that is not by resorting to crime, because you have this extraordinary disconnect between the rate of crime and the rate of imprisonment, but by looking at the role of the prison, in a sense, the extra penological function of the role of the prison as a regulator of poverty on the one side, with the rise of unemployment, and then as a regulator of race, as an institution that will shore up the crumbling ethno-racial order after the, in a sense, the success of the civil rights movement. Another way of putting it is to say that the success of the civil rights movement was paid by the massive over-incarceration of lower-class African-Americans. And here I must insist on lower-class African-Americans, because oftentimes people make the connection between race and imprisonment, and they think this is a sort of a direct connection that concerns all persons of the black community. In reality, another stunning development during the last four decades is that the rolling out of this gigantic penal apparatus has actually benefited the black middle class. An educated black male today has half the probability of going to prison that he had 30 years ago. A lower class black person who doesn't have a high school education has six times the probability of going to prison today than he had 30 years ago. So we see this extraordinary divergence inside of the black community. So we see, in effect, a triple selection in the rolling out of the prison: a selection by class, a selection by race, and a selection by class inside of race, which I show in my book can only be obtained by selecting by place. That is, it's because the prison has been rolled out in and around the collapsing ghetto, what I call the hyper-ghetto, because it has now lost its economic function, it's lost its role, its capacity to protect its residents. So when the police, the courts, and the prison are rolled in and around the collapsing hyper-ghetto, this is why the prison captures overwhelmingly lower-class black and secondarily Latino men.
Let me ask you about ghettos and your definition of a ghetto, because a ghetto is often described as a poor, bleak, often racially segregated urban neighborhood. Is that, in your opinion, enough to describe a ghetto?
I'm glad you asked this question. Actually, not only is it not enough, it's actually the wrong definition. And I think part of the difficulty of understanding, you know, why the prison system ballooned that way is linked to the inability or the confusion about the question of what is a ghetto. So when you ask people, well, what do they have in mind when they hear the term ghetto? Typically, they think they have in mind a segregated area, they have in mind an area of intense poverty, or an area that's dilapidated, or an area where there's a lot of crime and vice and disrepair. disrepute, in a sense, an area that you don't want to go into. But really, that is not a ghetto. That might be a ghetto after it has collapsed and it has become impoverished and it has become, in a sense, denuded of all its resources. But historically and sociologically, a ghetto is not at all a poor neighborhood, a segregated neighborhood, a neighborhood of violence and vice. It's a contraption, it's an instrument whereby a dominant category encloses and contains a stigmatized population. Let me then give you the classical example. The term ghetto comes from 1516 in Venice, when the first ghetto of history, the Jewish ghetto of Venice, was invented. And what was the Jewish ghetto? The Jewish ghetto was the fact of pushing all Jews living in the city of Venice inside a restricted neighborhood that was assigned specifically to that population. Now, Jews had been segregated until then, but they were segregated largely because they asked to be. Sometimes they would even purchase the right to have their own neighborhoods so that they can engage in their cultural and religious activities on their own. What happens after 1516 is that because of the stigma attached to Jews by the Catholic religion, Jews are constrained to reside in a specific neighborhood that is now reserved to them, which means that all Jews are required to live in a district that is assigned to them, which means that every resident of that district is Jewish. So a ghetto emerges when we have the double assignation of a population to a territory and a territory to a population. And what happens then is that the dominant group, in this case, the Christian rulers of the city, are constraining Jews to reside in a separate district to do what? Because they need the presence of Jews in the city. Why did the Christian rulers of Venice want the Jews to be in the city? Because Jews at the time were a trading diaspora, which was in a position to provide access to long-distance trade, to long-distance luxury goods, to long-distance military goods, and to financial services, all of which were absolutely essential for the rulers of the nascent city-states to establish their courts and their primacy.
So the ghetto performed a very important economic function.
Exactly. So the ghetto served the function of extracting economic value out of a stigmatized group. So you want the group to be in the city because you want to extract value, but at the same time, you don't want to mix with this group because you believe that it is contaminated and contaminating. In the case of Jews, there was the belief that you shouldn't touch a Jew and you shouldn't mix with them because they were carriers of syphilis and apostasy. They would lead you to renounce your religion. And so they were a threat in the city. But you needed them in the city. So what do? Is you create this contraption that will be this reserved neighborhood where Jews were required to live. So during the day, they would come out in the city, they would perform their economic functions, and at night, they were supposed to go back to the ghetto of Venice, which we should recall enclosed by walls, you know, and guarded by guards. And at night, they would consort among themselves in intimate sphere among Jews exclusively. And then during the day, they would come out and fulfill their functions. So we see here that a ghetto is an institutional contraption that serves to do two things: to extract economic value out of a stigmatized population and to ostracize that population.
That's the voice of Loic Vacon. He's a professor of sociology at the University of California, Berkeley, and the author of Punishing the Poor, the Neoliberal Government of Social Insecurity, published by Duke University Press. Okay, so that's the situation in early Europe. Now we move to the U.S. and what's the analogy there? And I guess what you're getting at here is why ghettos no longer exist, in your opinion.
Yes. To understand why ghetto collapsed, you have to understand why they came into being and what they are. So now, from Renaissance Europe, where the Jewish ghetto was established as the first historical ghetto, then let's zoom to the United States in the early 20th century. The black ghettos of the United States, first of all, African Americans are the only group, the only population that has been ghettoized in American history. Every other ethnic categories has been segregated, has been discriminated. They may have been violent and so on and so forth. Not to say that they didn't suffer from ethnic domination, but they were never ghettoized. African Americans were the only group to be ghettoized starting in the 1910s. Why? For the following reasons. World War I stopped the flow of migrants from Western Europe. So the source of labor was getting depleted. But also, World War I created a booming economy. So you needed factory hands to build the armament and the bombs and the tanks to satisfy the military economy. And your factory hands had left because many of the workers were called to the front. And so there was an enormous need of labor in the northern industrial cities of the United States in the 1910s. And this need was satisfied by bringing in, by triggering the great black migration from the South. Now, as African Americans migrated from the South into the northern industrial cities, what they found is that they found that they were stigmatized, that they were constrained to reside in their separate district. And in their separate district, like Jews in Renaissance Europe, they created their own parallel institutions to protect themselves. And so we see again the same two functions of economic extraction and social ostracization playing out in the creation of the black belts of the American metropolis. So then, if we understand then that the ghetto is an institution that fulfills these two functions, economic extraction and social ostracization of a stigmatized category, then we understand also that it has two faces. From the standpoint of the dominant group, Christians in Renaissance Venice or whites in the Fordist Chicago, then it serves as an instrument of exclusion and an instrument of control and closure. It serves the dominant Christians in Venice and whites in Chicago to limit the life chances of Jews or of blacks and to keep them in their place, so to speak. But we must also understand that once the ghetto comes and exists, it creates a separate sphere in which the marginalized category can create its own institutions, can have its own life, can engage in relationships of mutual respect and mutuality among themselves, can be protected from everyday contact with Christians in the case of Jews or whites in the case of blacks. Indeed, just like the Jewish ghetto of Renaissance Europe, the black ghetto of the United States contained all the classes of the black community, and it was the basis of collective enrichment and collective promotion. The ghetto of Chicago, for instance, was the harbor of and the stronghold of the largest black bourgeoisie of the United States in the 1950s. It spawned the first black millionaire of Chicago, and so on and so forth. And so what happens is that the ghetto is also, from the standpoint of the subordinate category, it's also a buffer, it's a shield, and it plays this role as providing a complement of institutions that will then produce a unified identity and the capacity to act, and in particular the capacity to challenge racial domination. And this is why, in a sense, ghettos are, in modern societies, they are unstable entities, because they generate the seeds of their own destruction, if you wish. So this is why, so the ghetto in the United States essentially had a 50-year shelf life. One could argue, so it arose in the 1910s, in a sense, from below, from ethnic enmity and hostility and violence from below. It was reconstructed at the mid-century point around, especially during the New Deal, by the state from above, through the policies of housing in particular that massively subsidized the great white migration to the suburbs and created the great concentration of black poverty inside of the inner city. And then the ghetto collapsed. It collapsed in the 1960s because of three causes that came to converge in the 1960s. The first cause is economic. It's the shift from a industrial factory-based economy to a service decentralized economy that essentially made unskilled black labor in the inner city expendable. You no longer needed the large volumes of low-wage black workers to work in the meat plants and in the packing plants and in the steel mills and so on and so forth. That labor was simply no longer necessary. Secondarily, after African Americans migrate into the city, we have the great white migration to the suburb that shifts the center of political gravity of the country from city to suburbs and weakens the political capacity and the political influence of inner city residents. And thirdly, and importantly, of course, we have the civil rights movement. We have the revolt, the organized revolt of African Americans against continued racial domination. And the three elements, in a sense, converge. There's no longer an economic function, there's no longer a political place for the traditional ghetto, and African Americans refuse to continue to be held in separation, and the ghetto collapses. But it collapses not to be, in a sense, not to lead to fluid mobility and the ability of all African Americans to resettle inside the city where they wish. It collapses and it is replaced by a dual structure composed on the one side of what I call the hyper-ghetto, that is the remnants of the historic ghetto of old, but now a ghetto that has been dramatically transformed in that it is now doubly segregated by class and race. Also, the hyper-ghetto on the one side, which contains only the dispossessed fractions of the black lower class, and then satellite black middle class neighborhoods that are created in the areas that were vacated as whites moved to the suburbs. And so instead of the communal ghetto of the 1950s that used to hold together in one single community, unified by race and differentiated by class, all African Americans, with a full complement of black institutions run by blacks for blacks, providing a buffer and a means of solidarity and community building, what we have after the mid-1970s, we have the growing divergence between the hyper-ghetto on the one side and the black satellite, you know, neighborhoods on the other. So the hyper-ghetto, what is the difference between the hyper-ghetto and the communal ghetto, the traditional ghetto? Well, the hyper-ghetto is a ghetto that has lost its economic function of extraction. It is no longer able, it doesn't generate the income to sustain the web of parallel institutions that provide the shield. So it loses its economic function. It also loses its shielding capacity, and it becomes doubly segregated by race and class. And it is a naked instrument of, in a sense, warehousing and exclusion, no longer an instrument of protection and mobility and solidarity and pride. And the communal institutions that used to dominate everyday life in the black ghettos of Chicago or New York or Detroit or Baltimore in the 1950s have been gradually replaced by the social control institutions of the state, and particularly by the growing penetration of the police, the courts, and the prison system.
And on that topic, you have compared ghettos, hyper-ghettos, to prisons. What are the conceptual and practical realities that make that comparison possible and very compelling in your mind?
As soon as we understand that a ghetto is not simply a segregated area or an impoverished area, but really sort of an ethno-racial prison, it's a contraption that serves to imprison a particular category that is stigmatized, but that whose presence in the city is needed for typically for economic reasons. Well, as soon as you realize that, then you see the parallel with a prison. Indeed, you can demonstrate, as I do in the book, that the building blocks of the ghetto and the building blocks of the prison are the same. Now, what are the building blocks of the ghetto? In order to have a ghetto, you must first have a stigmatized population. So stigma is your first element. Second element, that stigmatized population must be forced to reside in a particular district. If it chooses to reside in a district of its own, we are in a different configuration. So we have stigma, then we have constraints, and this constraint serves to confine spatially that population. So we have stigma, constraint, spatial confinement. And because of that spatial confinement, that stigmatized population develops its own web of institutions. It engages in what we can call institutional parallelism. It duplicates the city on a miniature inferior scale, if you wish, so that the Jewish ghetto is what? It's a Jewish city inside of the Christian city. The black ghetto is what? Is a black city contained inside of the white city. Inferior and dependent, but with its own autonomy and with its own duplicative order. And so we see these four elements: stigma, constraint, spatial confinement, and institutional parallelism and specificity. Well, this is replicated in the prison. What is a prison, if not a place where we put people who are stigmatized by what? By a legal sanction. They have committed a crime, they are convicted of this crime, this conviction is in a sense a stain, it stigmatizes them, it reduces their right, they can be then subjected to constraints, this is our second element, to be deprived of liberty. Nobody walks into a prison out of their own free will. You have to be constrained to go into prison. And where do they go? Well, in a spatial container, in a spatial contraption. Where they do what? What do prisoners do when they land behind bars? Well, typically they develop their own parallel institutions to adapt to the pains of the deprivation of liberty and autonomy and safety and so on and so forth. And so they develop their own parallel contraband economy. They develop their own parallel social and family structure, their own norms and values, and so on. And so, in essence, we have the same four building blocks that make the ghetto make the prisons. And when we go back to the history of the prison, we realize that also the functions of the prison and the ghetto are nearly identical. If we go back to the 16th century, which, not coincidentally, this is not by happenstance, my thesis that the two are related. The invention of the ghetto and the invention of the prison are coextensive. They came during the same period in early modern Europe, in the great transition from the feudal to the capitalist order. And what happened is that in the 16th century, prisons were invented and rose first in England and in the Netherlands and in northern Germany and in France, not to fight crime, but to manage marginality, to manage the wave of urban vagrants and the wave of the urban poor that were suddenly amassing in the emerging cities of Europe during that early commercial capitalist era.
And they were dispossessed from the land and they had to move into the urban areas and the land was being privatized and enclosed.
Yes, and so they came into the city and because the capitalist economy had not yet developed, well, there was no room for them. And so they found themselves sort of caught in this hiatus, in this transitional phase between the collapsing feudal order and the emerging capitalist order. And so these waves of vagrants and beggars and so on that became the plague of cities in the 16th century, the response of the emerging rulers was to invent the prison, not again to fight crime, but to manage urban marginality. And at that time, interestingly enough, the prison had two functions. It serves to, in a sense, warehouse and contain the poor, but also it serves as a means of inculcating the discipline of wage labor. All the first prisons were houses of corrections where the beggars, and particularly the able-bodied beggars, were, in a sense, forced to work. And the idea was that they will learn the work ethic behind bars. And when they come out, they will agree to work as a servant or as a wage earner when eventually wage labor emerges. And so what we discover there is that this function of economic, in a sense, disciplining, and this function of ostracization was also played by the prison in the phase of its early invention. And so we have, in a sense, a structural similarity and a functional similarity between the ghetto and the prison. So we can understand better, of course, why in the United States, when the black ghetto collapsed, in a sense, there was an institution that sort of offered itself as the sort of logical substitute or complement for the collapsing ghetto, and it was the prison, and this is the reason why the prison grew so massively in the United States.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song, and Loic Vacon joins us in our KPFA Berkeley studios. He teaches sociology at the University of California, Berkeley. His books include Prisons of Poverty, Urban Outcasts, A Comparative Sociology of Advanced Marginality, and Pierre Bourdieu and Democratic Politics. He's an ethnographer and social theorist, and we are talking to some degree about his new book, Punishing the Poor, The Neoliberal Government of Social Insecurity. We have a link to that book and to Vacon's homepage at Kale on our website, againstthegrain.org. Well, let's talk about welfare and workfare, which, you know, the kind of the right to welfare was replaced in the 90s, it appears, by the obligation of workfare. Maybe you could describe that more. But what you do is you tie in your book welfare and workfare to what you call prison fare, and we'll get to that term in a moment. But the right to welfare is obviously and prominently under attack. It's been under serious attack for about two decades. Tell us about the social attitudes and policies that undergird and implement these kinds of attacks.
It's good that we come to the second link, because in a sense, there are two forces that have pushed the prison boom in the United States after the mid-70s. One is the collapse of the ghetto that we just talked about, but the second is also the rise of poverty and the new way of regulating the poor. And this is where we must connect transformations in penal policy, criminal justice policy, the fight on crime, with transformations of social welfare policy. Perhaps the major argument, if there is a single major argument that I make in the book, is that we cannot understand shifts in criminal justice without also understanding correlative shifts in social welfare policy, because the two are linked. They are two variants. Criminal justice and welfare or workfare are two variants of poverty policy. In a sense, it used to be that in this country, poverty was regulated by welfare. And there's a great book written by two eminent colleagues, Francis Fox Piven and Richard Cloward, published in 1971, that's a classic of social science called Regulating the Poor, The Functions of Social Welfare. And in that book, they show that poverty relief expands and contracts along with the cycles of the labor market. When unemployment goes up, welfare increases. When unemployment goes down, welfare is shrunk so that the poor will take the jobs that have now become available. And what I argue is that this model worked. It was correct largely in the sense for the half century opened by the New Deal. But by the 1980s and 90s, there's a shift in social welfare policy. Instead of having this sort of cyclical expansion and contraction of welfare, what we see is a gradual shift from the right to welfare as a protection from the sanction of the market to the obligation of workfare. That is, that you will receive public aid as a condition, on condition that you agree to take up, in a sense, the insecure part-time sub-poverty wages that are now the mainstay of employment for the unskilled fractions of the post-industrial working class. And the rolling out of workfare becomes combined with the rolling out of what I call prison fare, that is the activation of the police, the courts, and the prison system, not so much to fight crime as to regulate poverty. And so we see a sort of a convergence of what, using the theories of the French sociologist Pierre Bourdieu, I call the left hand of the state, which is the social welfare arm, which is the protective and supportive arm of the state, and the right hand of the state, which is the paternal punitive arm of the state, which is in this particular case the police, the courts, and the prison system, instead of, in a sense, the one-armed maternalist regulation of poverty through welfare. What we see emerging in that period, and especially, in a sense, being enshrined by the welfare reform, the Work Responsibility and Opportunity Act of 1996, which reformed welfare as we knew it under President Clinton. What we see there is the merging of the double regulation of the poor through disciplinary restrictive workfare. Workfare becomes restrictive and becomes an instrument to discipline the poor and push them in the deregulated segments of the labor market. But similarly, prison fare is expensive and converges with prison fare, so that we now have the double regulation of poverty through restrictive workfare and expensive prison fare, which converge to do three things: to discipline the reticent fractions of the post-industrial working class to accept insecure wage work as the mainstay of their life and their condition. Also to warehouse and to neutralize the most disruptive sectors of that post-industrial working class by just, in a sense, keeping them behind bars with no pretense of corrections, no pretense of improving, no pretense of really reducing crime other than keeping them, under lock. And very importantly, there's a third function served by the rolling out of restrictive workfare and expensive prison fare, is to reassert the authority of the state, to reassert the fortitude of the ruler, and to shore up the deficit of legitimacy that political elites suffer when they roll out the traditional missions of social and economic protection of the state. And so we see, in a sense, my argument there is that, we must link, to understand the rise of the penal state, we must do a double link. We must link it on the one side to the collapse of the black ghetto, but also on the other side, we must link it to the transformation of the labor market and the transformation of social welfare policy, the shift from the right to welfare protection to the obligation of workfare discipline.
I'm CS, he's Loic Vacant, Vacquant, sociology professor at UC Berkeley, and author of Punishing the Poor, The Neoliberal Government of Social Insecurity. It's the second volume of a planned trilogy about the urban poor. The first volume was Urban Outcasts, A Comparative Sociology of Advanced Marginality. He also wrote, among other books, a volume called Body and Soul, Notebooks of an Apprentice Boxer, which is a more personal story. We'll take a short music break and speak more with Loic. Please stay with us. We'll be right back. Ken. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, online at kpfa.org. On our website, againstthegrain.org, we've put up a link to Loic Vacon's homepage at UC Berkeley, where he teaches sociology, as well as to the book Punishing the Poor, published by Duke University Press. You write that the prevailing social and penal regime is gendered, that it has different intentions for women and men. How so?
I'm glad that you pick up on that argument, because I think that part of the punitive turn that we observe in the United States and in many other advanced societies, both on the social welfare front and on the penal front, is part of a remasculinizing of the state, is part of reasserting the sort of the fatherly duty of the state as disciplinary agent. And in the case of the United States, it takes a particularly dramatic gendered form, in that the combination of restrictive workfare on the one side and expensive prison fare on the other side is directed at two very different populations. Restrictive workfare is directed at the women and their children, and it will, in a sense, teach them the discipline and the duty of work for work's sake, even if, in fact, that work doesn't allow them to support their own family, or even if there is no work available. They will have to go through this program, in a sense, show that they are good citizens who abide by this ethic of work. And workfare distinctively targets women, and through women, the children. And then prison fare targets the men. Now, what is the most interesting aspect of this, and for me, one of the most surprising findings that I made when I worked on the book, is that these are the men of these women. That is, in this gender division of labor, of the control of the poor, with workfare handling the women and prison fare handling the men, it is the men of those women, meaning it is the brothers, it is the cousins, it is the husbands, it is the boyfriends, it is the sons of the same women whose life is regulated by workfare, find themselves under the tutelage of prison fare. They are actually the same lineages that live in the same dispossessed neighborhoods, gutted out by the policies of urban withdrawal and economic deregulation and social welfare retrenchment, who find themselves, for the women, under the tutelage of workfare, and for the men, under the tutelage of prison fare.
One term that people on the left often use to describe the penal system in this country is the prison industrial complex, which suggests that prisons have become a sort of industry, and that the generation of profits by, for example, the labor of inmates, the very low wage or no wage labor of inmates, is a primary motivation behind the boom in incarceration. What do you say to all of this?
I think the notion of prison industrial complex, I think, is an activist demonology. It's an activist myth that doesn't correspond to the reality of the development of the prison in the United States. Now, I share with the advocates of the prison industrial complex, you know, the critique of these developments. I also share their wish to, in a sense, stop and roll back, you know, the prison system. Like them, I believe that, you know, there's excessive imprisonment in the United States, that there's grave inequalities, grave injustices, and so on and so forth. And in many ways, I admire their activities, and I admire the energies that they have poured into these activities. But I think that one can show that the profit motive is not the driving factor behind the rolling out of the prison in the United States. That is, it is primarily an exercise in state's crafting. It is a transformation of the state, of its perimeter, of its missions, and of its priorities.
It's a political project rather than an economic,
one.
Rather than a profit-generating
motive. Exactly. And I think that when the advocates of the prison industrial complex want to direct us to fighting the pecuniary interests and the profit-seeking corporations and so on, they divert our attention and they divert our energy from what is really essential, which is the remaking of the state. And I think you can show that pretty easily on several fronts. If you look at the four major claims that are made by the prison industrial complex advocates, is first, they argue that the prison industrial complex, you know, they say it will develop like the military industrial complex. It's by analogy to the military industrial complex that refers to under Eisenhower, you know, private firms and the Pentagon and politicians had a vested interest in colluding in the perpetual expansion of the military sphere. The idea is that this has been applied in a sense domestically now to the prison and to crime control, where, you know, public officials and private profiteers of imprisonment and the media have become this, are colluding into create these vast opportunities for profit and control. Well, there can be no analogy with criminal justice for the simple reason that military policy is driven by a single command center. There is the Pentagon, which sets policies and sets priorities and sets expenses and sets procedures and so on. So if you wanted to capture military policy, you could, in a sense, you know, direct yourself at the Pentagon. And once you control the Pentagon, then you control military policy. But there isn't a criminal justice system in the United States. Each state runs its prison system separately. Each county runs its prosecution office separately. Each city runs its police district separately. There's a hodgepodge patchwork of hundreds of separate jurisdictions and bureaucracies that each manage policing, justice, and incarceration separately from one another without any instrument of general coordination. Just to give you the figures, there are 18,000 different local and state law enforcement agencies that decide their own policing strategies on their own. You have 2,341 distinct prosecutor's offices that set their judicial policies. You have, of course, the thousands of counties that run their own jail. And then you have the 50 states that each run their system separately. So first thing, the analogy between the military industrial complex and the prison industrial complex, really, it's not an analogy. It's only a rhetorical metaphor that breaks down immediately. But more importantly, on the economic front.
Yeah, I mean, what about the argument that prisons are being turned into sweatshops of corporations seeking low-wage labor, that there are all these, I think it's been called in headlines, factories behind bars?
That's the second claim of the prison industrial complex folks, is that prisons have become sites of exploitation of labor. Well, the reality is that at peak use of inmates by private companies, by private firms behind bars, fewer than 2,000 inmates were employed. 2,000 out of 2.3 million people behind bars. That's less than 0.5%. That's less than 0.5% of inmates have been employed. Similarly, if you look at the inmates who are employed by the what is called the PIE program, the Prison Industries Authority run by the federal government, where there's about 80,000 inmates who are in this program, the reality is that that program is subsidized by the federal government and is run at a deficit. It's a make work. You know, it's a pretense of an economic program, but it runs in the red every year. So in reality, there is no exploitation, or the exploitation of prison labor is a sideshow. It's a curiosity. It concerns a tiny minority of convicts.
The advocates of this prison industrial complex analysis also argue that private firms are getting rich off the design and the building and even the management of prisons. What's your response to that?
The reality is that they are a sideshow. Private builders, designers, and so on have captured about 7% of the total number of beds. And it's never going to grow much for the simple reason that private incarceration firms want to cherry pick their inmates. They don't want the costly inmates. They can only make money if they don't get older inmates, if they don't get sick inmates, if they don't get inmates with long disciplinary records. So in fact, they are only interested in a tiny sliver of the carceral market. Also for the reason that when you do a full accounting of how much it costs to run a private prison and the subsidies that they get on the construction side and so on, states have shown, particularly in Arizona, a recent study commissioned by the state of Arizona showed that in fact private incarcerators cost slightly more than the public sector. But more importantly, what is distinctive is that, so people point to the presence of private firms involved in incarceration, and they say 7% of inmates are behind bars in private facilities. But what is distinctive is that this is very small. It means that 93% are in public facilities. And note the contrast. Every single public service in the United States, whether it's education, whether it's housing, whether it's health, whether it's welfare, is actually delivered by a mixed private and public apparatus. And in fact, education is much more privatized. Welfare is much more privatized. Health is much more privatized. Housing is much more privatized. What is really distinctive about incarceration is the degree to which it has remained an exclusive, near exclusive province of public authority. And so when you compare punishment to the other major government functions, you realize that in fact, contrary to the other state functions, incarceration has remained doggedly, nearly exclusively public. And there's a reason why, is that the prison is a core political capacity through which the state projects its sovereignty and projects its authority. And so it doesn't want to abandon that. It will never abandon it. So yes, there are private firms that are involved, but they are a sideshow. They are a consequence of the inability of the penal state to develop its facilities and to develop its own organizational capacities fast enough to absorb the large number of convicts that it has generated. But it's a sideshow and it's a minor consequence. And let me add just the point that I want to make about the overall weight. So one of the claims of the prison industrial complex folks is that prisons have grown so big that now they're a central sector of the American economy, and even of the global capitalist economy. They even talk about a global lockdown and the global prison industrial complex. Now, on the face of it, this claim is absolutely absurd, because as much as incarceration has grown in the United States, and it has grown, is the single fastest growing government, you know, expenditure over the last 30 years, it is still, with $70 billion, it still only represents, relative to a gross domestic product of $14.4 trillion, it still represents only 0.5% of the U.S. economy, which means that if you deleted all prisons in America tomorrow, the American economy would be virtually unchanged. So the claim that it has become central is vastly exaggerated. The claim that prison serves to exploit labor is demonstrably false. The claim that there's a parallel between MIC and PIC, the military-industrial complex, and the prison-industrial complex doesn't hold. And the idea that the private motive is a driving factor also doesn't hold. And so I would invite the advocates and the militants of the prison-industrial complex to, in a sense, focus where the focus should be, which is on the building of the penal state, which is a political project, which engages conceptions of citizenship and conceptions of the priorities, missions of the state, and to forget about the chimera of the profiteers. You know, whenever the U.S. provides a public service, they're always at the table. There are always private companies that will profit. This is true for education. This is true for housing. This is true for health. This is true for security, and so on and so forth. But what is distinctive about punishment, this is not true about punishment. Punishment has remained a distinctively public function. And so this is why I think that my explanation of the rise of the penal state diverges from and provides us with a better tool for mobilizing than the demonology of the prison industrial complex.
So, Loïc Vacon, given your systemic and structural analysis of the growing penal state in this country, is it, in your opinion, enough to make reforms at the level of, you know, the criminal courts, prisons, and police? You know, some people say we should abolish mandatory sentencing. Some say that we have to deal with low-level drug offenders in a more lenient manner. Are reforms at that level enough to change the disturbing trends in the penal system of this country?
Well, my first point is these reforms are necessary and they are urgent, but they are not sufficient. So yes, we should use intermediate sanctions to divert low-level offenders from prisons. In particular, we should divert mentally ill persons and the homeless from prisons towards, you know, housing facilities and medical facilities. We should, you know, abolish mandatory minimum sentences. We should, you know, in general, reduce the length of prison sentences across the board. Of course, reform parole revocation, incorporate fiscal and social impact into judicial proceedings and promote restorative justice. Yes, all of this we should do, but all of this is necessary, but it is not sufficient. If my analysis is correct, and if the penalization of poverty is part and parcel of a broader remaking of the state, then we must, in a sense, attack the state. We must remake the state to end this revanchist, punitive turn. And in particular, we must rebuild the economic and social capacities of the state. Ironically, this was what the financial crisis of 2008 has shown, is that, well, when the market collapsed, suddenly you need the state to save, you know, the financial sector, and you need the state to stabilize the housing market, and you need the state to stabilize the labor market. So we have seen the reassertion of the economic capacity of the state. What we must have to roll back this excessive penalization is both make the criminal justice reforms that I mentioned earlier, but also rebuild the economic capacities of the state, rebuild the social welfare capacities of the state, and lastly and importantly, if my analysis of the linkage between the hyper-ghetto and the prison system is correct, we must also have spatially targeted policies that will provide social and economic resources in the inner city where we see this nexus of race, class, and penalization has taken on, you know, an extreme form, and a form that now, in a sense, can sort of, you know, maintain itself, can perpetuate itself. The convicts coming out in large numbers in devastated neighborhoods without any economic opportunities, without any social support. Their families and their neighborhoods are being devastated by the penetration of the penal state. Well, they come out and essentially they can only go back to the illegal drug economy, which means that sooner or later they'll be recaptured and they will recycle back into the prison system. So to stop this reverberating cycle between the hyper-ghetto and the overgrown prison system, we must also have, I advocate, a spatially targeted policies that will improve inner city neighborhoods as they are today, not wait for the economy to get better, not wait for social welfare to get better, not wait for criminal justice to get better, but really target those areas, you know, through intensive programs, for instance, through a program such as a WPA, you know, jobs program that would come into the devastated neighborhoods of West Oakland, of South Central LA, of the South Side of Chicago, or of Baltimore, and would provide jobs to the young men in those neighborhoods and young women in those neighborhoods, provide jobs to rebuild the neighborhoods. This will provide housing. This will help stabilize families. This will improve proximate social control and reduce delinquency and crime. And this will allow, you know, in a sense, for the restoration of the normal conditions of life in those neighborhoods. So, yes, we need this criminal justice reform, but they will not be sufficient. We need economic and social reform, and we need a targeted urban strategies to attack those areas where the deadly nexus of prison fare and work fare on the one side and prison fare and hyper-ghettoization are located.
Loïc Vacon, sociologist at the University of California, Berkeley. His books include Prisons of Poverty, Urban Outcasts, Pierre Bourdieu, and Democratic Politics, and the book we've been discussing today, Punishing the Poor, the Neoliberal Government of Social Insecurity. Thanks so much, Loïc, for joining me today.
Thank you.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning. We will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio. Yeah, it's free. And sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670. And think about befriending us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.